here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Monday, July 9th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. Broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:03 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We'll also bring you coverage of UBC's Sexual Assault Center. Claire, could you give us a description of that?
For sure. So we'll be bringing you coverage from UBC Sexual Assault Support Center of the Vancouver Police Department's Women's Safety Fair, which took place over this past weekend. And then we'll also go in depth about a recent debate over Abbotsford's review of a zoning bylaw that could allow mobile needle exchanges and sites similar to Insight in Vancouver's downtown east side. And we also had a chance to talk to Tim Meyer, head of communications at the Triumph National Laboratory for Particle and Nuclear Physics here at UBC, about the recent discovery of a Higgs-like particle at the LHC in CERN.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast brought to you by Phil from the UBC Storm Club right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for our interview.
Yeah, so Vancouver Police held its first ever Women's Safety Fair designed to give women the tools to protect themselves and raise awareness about community resources. The fair featured numerous information booths by community groups and a women-only personal safety demonstration by the VPD. So for more info, we talked to Anissa Motahid from UBC's Sexual Assault Support Center, who was there this weekend. So hi, Anissa. Hello, Anissa?
Hello?
Anissa? Hi, Anissa. Oh, it looks like we've lost her. Okay, so I think we'll bring you our local headlines first, and then we'll bring you back that interview. We'll try and get her on the line again. So we'll try and contact her and bring you that interview shortly.
All right. So to start off with your local headlines.
Another BC First Nation has taken a stand against the construction and upgrading of pipelines that will carry petroleum products from Alberta's oil sands to the Pacific coast. During a weekend ceremony, North Vancouver's Tsleil-Waututh Nation added its name to the Save the Fraser Declaration. Signatories to the document vow they will not allow pipelines carrying oil sands products to cross their lands, territories, or watersheds, or the migration routes of Fraser River salmon. Tsleil-Waututh Chief Justin George says his band has an obligation and birthright to care for the lands and water in its territory. The declaration was initially drawn up by the Yinka Dene Alliance, a coalition of six First Nations in northern BC, to block the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline from being built on their territories. More than 130 First Nations have now signed the declaration. The signing received the blessing of Vancouver City Councillors Adrienne Carr and Andrea Reimer, and NDP MP for Burnaby Douglas Kennedy Stewart, who served as formal witnesses in this ceremony. Although not in attendance, the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Sean Atleo, sent a laudatory letter to the Tsleil-Waututh, which was read in his absence. In it, he said, quote, "I extend my full support for the exercise of your rights and responsibilities in this matter. As a national advocacy organization, we stand in full solidarity with you," end quote. In doing this, Atleo cited the federal government's obligation as a signatory to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People to consult with First Nations and accommodate their demands where possible on projects affecting their lands. Two major pipeline projects are currently planned for BC, including Enbridge's $5.5 billion Northern Gateway Pipeline and Kinder Morgan Canada's expansion of its Trans Mountain Pipeline. Public opinion in British Columbia has been strongly opposed to the project, which has received support from the federal government. And now for our in-depth report on Abbotsford's review of a zoning bylaw. Every Thursday over the past year, members of Vancouver's Portland Hotel Society have been visited Abbotsford in a black SUV that is now makeshift mobile needle exchange. In Abbotsford, this transaction has actually been illegal since 2005, when City Council passed a zoning bylaw that effectively bans any form of harm reduction, including needle exchanges and safe injection sites within the city limits. But the bylaw is now up for review as a local health authority pushes for a government-run needle exchange program, and community groups that have been quietly contravening the law for years argue it's time for the city to embrace the concept of harm reduction.
The debate has revealed that some in the city are still uncomfortable with the idea of giving addicts free needles to inject their drugs. Despite the insistence of health officials that such programs save lives, reduce healthcare costs, and connect addicts with treatment. The harm reduction bylaws was introduced 7 years ago as municipal politicians looked to ensure the blight of addiction in Vancouver's downtown east side didn't replicate itself in Abbotsford. At the time, city councillors argued allowing any form of harm reduction would merely condone drug use. The Fraser Health Authority recently asked city council to reconsider the bylaw, pointing to statistics that show Abbotsford has some of the province's highest rates of overdoses and infections of HIV and hepatitis C. The health authority presented a proposal to council last month, that would see a needle exchange program phased in over several years, beginning with distribution through community organizations and then eventually introducing mobile and fixed-site needle exchange services. Municipal staff have been asked to study the proposal before the city decides what to do with the bylaw, but some councillors have revived the same concerns that prompted the bylaw in the first place.
David Portezzi, the Fraser Health Authority's public health director, says city council made a mistake when it passed the bylaw, but now he sees an opportunity to change that. Portezzi notes several organizations already pass out harm reduction supplies in Abbotsford, and the city doesn't appear to be using the bylaw to stop them. The Fraser Health Authority is also looking into whether the city can legally enforce a bylaw that restricts the healthcare service. Abbotsford Mayor Bruce Bandman said city council remains deeply divided on the issue, although he personally believes the bylaw should be repealed. Bandman, a chiropractor by trade, says he's convinced a needle exchange program would save lives and money by preventing addicts from contracting diseases such as HIV. However, he says his support is contingent on Fraser Health also promising to increase detox services in the community, something that he complains isn't part of the current proposal. Fraser Health says it's open to talking about expanding detox services for Abbotsford. Currently, the health authority provides mobile, in-home detox services, and Abbotsford residents who need to enter a treatment center are referred to a facility in nearby Surrey. And we now going to try again for our interview with Anissa Mutahed. She's from the UBC Sexual Assault Support Center, and she was at the Vancouver Police Department fair this past weekend. So, Anissa, how are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for joining us on the show. Sorry about the complications there, but it's great to have you. So we know that the Vancouver Police Department's Women's Safety Fair took place on Saturday. So could you just give us a bit of an overview of what that was?
So the Vancouver Police Department, for the first time, decided to have a Women's Safety Fair. And so a variety of social service agencies, including the Sexual Assault Support Center, were present at the fair to really raise awareness around the issues of women's safety and sexual assault and violence against women. In addition to that, the Vancouver Police Department had a personal safety demonstration in which they showed some tactical self-defense techniques to women that were present.
That sounds like a great initiative. And did you feel like people in the community responded to this?
We do feel that people did respond well to us being at the fair. People were saying that they were really glad that these agencies had all come together on a Saturday afternoon to really raise awareness about women's safety and security.
Mm-hmm. And that's definitely something that, at least from a personal standpoint, I feel like has been gaining more and more, notice in the media over the past year, especially with I guess, what was happening with the slut walk starting in Toronto and the response of the police department there and sort of spreading nationally. How do you feel like the response, I guess, on campus in particular to concerns about women's safety and sexual assault have grown or changed in the past year?
That's a really good question. I feel that women's safety sometimes, for the most part, is something that's neglected, and that women at times are looked at being held responsible for not becoming victimized. Mm-hmm. So sometimes a lot of responsibility from police and the sorts, they're putting responsibility on women. And so it's more about shifting the rape culture that we live in instead of actually making women feel more responsible.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I think it's very interesting that this is something that, I guess, obviously the Sexual Assault Support Center from UBC was involved in, but also brought community groups from across Vancouver. What were some of the other participants? Who were some of the other participants, and what kind of advice or insight did they offer?
Battered Women's Support Services was also present, as was WAVA, Women Against Violence Against Women. The Vancouver General Hospital Sexual Assault Services were also there, and a variety of other police-based services were there, including transit police, child security police.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so they all brought in a variety of different perspectives and initiatives that they're working on to share with passersby.
And what do you feel some key issues are when it comes to awareness in terms of women's safety are?
Well, we're really big on prevention and education. Mm-hmm. So we really feel at the Sexual Assault Support Center that education and awareness opportunities are really key for people to learn about shifting the culture that we live in, about shifting this rape culture that we live in.
And what are some key actions that you feel people could take to try and shift this, I guess, this rape culture into something that's more, more safe? And
yeah, I think having an activist in the community, learning about issues that are prevalent, really participating in social service agencies, so for like ours, volunteering and really getting the word out and offering outreach. In addition to, people can read up on our website more information about other opportunities that do exist.
That's great. Well, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today and teach us a bit about that.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. So once again, that was Anissa Motahead from the Sexual Assault Support Center here at UBC. She was telling us a bit about the Vancouver Police Department's Women's Safety Fair, which happened on July 7th, which was Saturday. So for more info on that, you can check out the SASC website at ams.ubc.ca. So we are going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your provincial and national headlines as well as your local weather forecast. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. The 35th Annual Vancouver Folk Music Festival comes to Jericho Beach Park July 13th to 15th. From Dan Mangan, The Head and the Heart, and Hey Rosetta, to the voice of Tunisia's Amel Mathluthi and Mozambique's Wazimbo, there are artists you know and love, plus a world of amazing music to discover. 3 evenings, 2 full days of music and magic. You want to be there. Info and tickets at thefestival.bc.ca. Supported in part by CITR 101.9 FM.
I went out into the darkness.
Imaginary cities.
Darkness turned to light.
Back from their international tour.
When I found my
this Winnipeg
freedom,
band is known for being exuberant and anthemic at times, moody and soulful at others.
Say you.
Don't miss Imaginary Cities, live at the Waldorf on July 12th. Buy your tickets at livenation.com, Ticketweb, or charge by phone at 1-888-222-6608.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. It is now time for your weekday weather forecast, brought to you by Phil Chang from the UBC Storm Club. Hi, Phil.
Hi, CJ. Always good to hear your voice. And hey, Claire, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Okay. So, good evening, listeners. I'm very happy to say that it seems the fine weather that everyone is enjoying so much for the past few days is most likely going to stay with us for the next week to come. There is a low pressure heading towards us from the northwest direction, but according to the most recent 72-hour loop on the GFS, even as late as Thursday, that system should still be kilometers off our shores. So, yeah, in summary, no anticipated precipitation, minimal clouds, a light breeze above about 5 kilometers per hour tops, and daylight temperatures of over 20 degrees each day. It's going to be a great week here in Vancouver. All right, so a 5-day weekday weather summary. Tonight, clear skies, increasing cloudiness after midnight, low of 14. Tuesday, clear in the morning, high of 22, 26 inland, a UV index of 7 or higher. Tuesday night, a few clouds, low of 15. Wednesday, a mix of sun and cloud, high of 23, 27 inland. Thursday, also a mix of sun and cloud, low of 15, high of 22, 26 inland. Friday, sunny, low of 15, high of 23, 28 inland. All right, so yeah, that's your weekday weather summary courtesy of Environment Canada. Reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang from the Storm Club.
Thank you, Phil. That sounds amazing.
That's the best weather you've told us yet.
Yeah. Thanks so much. See you guys.
All right.
Bye,
goodbye.
Phil.
And that was Phil from the UBC Storm Club. Thank you for being with us. You're listening to News 101. It's now time for your
interview with Tim Meyer, head of communications at the Triumph National Laboratory for Particle and Nuclear Physics here at UBC, about the recent discovery of a Higgs-like particle at the LHC in CERN. So this interview was conducted by our very own reporter, Nina Kirgia.
I have Tim Meyer here, head of communications at the Triumph Lab here at UBC. Hi, Tim.
Hi, good morning.
So tell us a little bit about the Higgs boson particle.
Yeah, so we've had a big breakthrough with the observation of a brand new particle that we think is the missing piece to the standard model. And the Higgs boson is a special particle. It's actually been part of the description of how we understand the subatomic world for almost 35 years when it was first imagined to exist. And it really is the last component that was required to say that all of the machinery that we use to make calculations about chemistry and physics, we actually have observed all the elements that drive those calculations. So this Higgs boson is the validation that there actually is an energy field which is giving mass to all particles. So as particles move in the standard model, they should all be traveling at the speed of light. And in fact, they should have zero mass. It's only when we introduce the Higgs mechanism, which allows those particles to interact with sort of like molasses as they're traveling along, that they slow down. So the Higgs mechanism is akin to why it's harder to push a heavy box than a light box. And this has all these subatomic particles experience mass and slow down by interacting with the Higgs field. So this observation and the announcement by the 6,000 physicists involved in both collaborations is really, it'll be the discovery, maybe not of the century, but certainly of the past 30 years. This is a huge accomplishment.
Yeah, so my understanding, it's a particle, but the way you're explaining it, it had to do with energy. Like, I didn't really understand. So it is a particle.
Yeah, so what we the way things work in particle physics is that you think about the surface of a lake. There's water there, and if it's a calm day, it's smooth. But when you see waves, that's really just a periodic, we call it an excitation, or it's a disturbance on the surface of the water. In fact, it's very hard to set up a wave in, say, a solid piece of ice because it's solid. Yeah. So we can actually learn a lot about the lake by looking at the structure of the waves on the surface. In a similar way, a particle is like the wave on the surface, that other medium. So when we say we've seen the Higgs boson, we've actually seen a particle, but it also allows us to infer that there's an energy field there which has an excited state, which is the particle that we observed.
Okay, so they were studying this at the CERN for a while, mm-hmm. and I'm just wondering, what's the significance of the finding? Why were they trying so hard to find something when immediately it doesn't make any big difference?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. Does this discovery change, you know, what you're going to have for breakfast tomorrow? Absolutely not. But I think there's sort of two sides to the coin to respond to that. And one is, you know, ever since, you know, humans first came out of the caves and looked up at the night sky, they're curious and we're interested and we're sort of on this, call it a spiritual or an intellectual or a cultural quest, like, you know, what is the universe that we're in and how does it work and what is our role in it? So part of the quest for understanding what happens inside the atom and what happens at the most microscopic scale and what happens of a second after the Big Bang is just that curiosity of actually understanding and marveling at how our world actually works.
Exactly, yeah.
I think and then the other thing is, of course, you know, where science is sort of a public pursuit is that these types of quests to understand these seemingly obscure questions really challenge our technologies. And then as we become more skilled and build new tools, we develop side benefits that actually have the real-world impact. So CERN was actually the place that developed the World Wide Web and those protocols, but had nothing to do with e-commerce. They were trying to share data between particle physics experiments.
Oh, wow.
And then 5 to 8 years later, bam, you've got the Internet and you've got, you know, Pizza Hut delivering pizza from a website.
Yeah. So when you were talking about the Big Bang, so this, what role would the Higgs boson have in the Big Bang?
Yeah, so, you know, after the Big Bang, which is when we say it all started, you know, the universe was expanding and this massive, dense, hot energy ball was expanding. It should have just continued being energy. And we would just have a universe that's filled with some diffuse energy. And it's the Higgs mechanism that actually allows, as that energy expands and cools, that there's actually some mass. Remember, E equals mc squared from Einstein. Mm-hmm. The question was, well, why is there an m and how did the m get there? And the Higgs mechanism and the Higgs particle is actually the mechanism, and it's actually the reason ended up with matter in the universe. So without the Higgs mechanism, we wouldn't have our world. So the Higgs boson is that missing piece that says, you know what, we think we do understand how this works, and now we have a consistent description.
So that's where the God particle came from.
The God particle is a bit of a misnomer. It actually came from an argument between a Nobel laureate and his book publisher about how to title a book. Leanne Letterman said, we've been looking for this particle, it's the keystone, and it's hard to find, it's a goddamn particle. And the publisher said, we can't put that on the front of the book, let's call it the God particle.
That's how that starts. So it didn't even start from just another way of saying it. Like,
no, it didn't even start as a holy grail or anything. It was actually someone cursing about the challenges.
So that's why scientists very much dislike that name for it.
Yeah, I would say we're never going to live it down, but in the grand scheme, you know, people seem to smile when they hear it, so what the heck.
And
you know?
I feel like it's helped people kind of understand what it is when you say God particle. It's like, oh, okay, like it started life.
Yeah, it is truly. Yeah, and in some sense, some people call it, it's, you know, the Holy Grail, just like, you know, the search for the Ark of the Covenant or something, you know, the quest that takes generations.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been building experiments and developing tools to work on this for decades. And so it is this sort of quest. And, you know, one of the really powerful moments was Peter Higgs was actually at the announcement in Geneva. We were watching this live by video conference at midnight. and he was really moved when they announced they'd actually discovered this particle. And then, you know, he had tears in his eyes. This has been something that's really important and significant, and you can imagine what it's like to know that this somewhat obscure idea is actually looks like it's how it actually happens in reality.
Of course, and he was the one who hypothesized it, I think, in the 60s?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's been quite some time.
So why has it taken so long to find?
Well, there's the real situation is we thought this mechanism in the particle existed, but we didn't actually know how heavy the particle itself was. So we thought there was this energy field, but, you know, question is, you know, how big is the wave on the surface of the lake? And how, you know, do you need a really strong wind to get the wave, or can you just throw in a pebble and get that wave? By analog in particle physics, we collide our beams of particles at higher and higher energies to see if we can create that particle. And the Higgs boson is, we see now, this particle weighs about 125 to 126 GeV. That's 130 times the mass of the proton. So it's a very heavy particle. We actually did not have the technology to create collisions that had enough energy to produce that particle. So it really has been the march of accelerators and detectors and computing that's allowed us to create the conditions where we could temporarily create a Higgs particle and then observe it.
Okay, so it's about collisions between...
We're colliding beams of protons at the Large Hadron Collider in CERN. So we're actually stripping out the core of atoms, accumulating them in bunches, and then firing, you know, trillions of these protons at each other. Occasionally they collide. Occasionally they produce a Higgs boson, and occasionally we observe it. So it's a...
Wow. So it's a... That's very, very cool. That sounds like a...
Yeah, they say it's not a needle in a haystack. You know, it's even worse than that. So.
Yeah, exactly. So just for the future of this, is there anything that you could do with this discovery that they're planning to do with specifically knowing now that the Higgs boson exists?
Well, there's two things. I'd say that, you know, is the Higgs boson going to change your breakfast in 15 years? And it's unlikely that the Higgs boson itself, or, you know, if this particle has something else to it. But I think what we can say is that we've now validated a description of subatomic physics. And this is the same description that's used to develop new semiconductors. It's the same description of calculations that are used to look at nanotechnology and quantum computing. So we really are starting to master this mathematical framework for understanding a lot of the emerging technology. So having observed the Higgs boson, we now have more confidence in that basic description.
Yeah.
The other side of it is that we're now going to study the heck out of this particle, because technically speaking, we've observed a particle that looks very much like the Higgs boson. Have we proven this is the bad boy? Not quite yet. We got to make sure we get its name, rank, serial number, and what it eats for breakfast, and you know, who it hangs out with. And then we'll say this is that particle. But as we study the heck out of it, we're actually going to be stretching into some of the questions we still don't understand. So I said we had this great calculation tool, the standard model, works great for quantum computing and nanotechnology and particle physics, but it doesn't actually explain the night sky.
Yeah.
And so by looking at this Higgs boson, we may actually finally have a breakthrough that says we're good and here's where we're absolutely wrong. And that may actually change everything, if we actually understand why antimatter is the way it is, as opposed to just saying, well, we see it that way.
Yeah, well, yeah, validating, of course. It's not just hypothesis anymore,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which Higgs must be very, very proud of.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, it's ironic. He's one of the questions they asked him is, you know, well, you know, what do you think about them calling it the Higgs particle? And his comment is that, you know, it wasn't just him that came up with this model of this energy field, this molasses that slows things down. There's sort of six people involved, and he says, you know, it shouldn't really call it the Higgs mechanism. There's these six guys that are involved. But you know what? He says, I really do feel like I'm the one who's been working for 30 years to say we should look for this particle.
Yeah.
So he's actually delighted to consider it the Higgs particle, because he thinks that's part of his contribution to saying let's look for this thing, as opposed to just call it a good idea and move on. So.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not a popularity contest anyway. It's
yeah.
it's science, but that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome.
I think the final thing I'd just say is this is... Yeah. The other thing that's really exciting, it's a global effort. I mean, all the way from
exactly.
UBC and UVic and Simon Fraser and Triumph to St. Mary's to, you know, there's 6,000 scientists from around the world, 137 countries, you know, and
of course,
and
as you're saying this, I'm thinking now if only we could all get along in other aspects.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's one of the reasons I still work with particle physics is because it's one of the few places that Israelis and Palestinians and Arabs and Jews and Germans and Americans and Canadians, if you bring up science, they're all going to sit down and work on it together. And, you know, it's inspiring. It's like if we can work on that together, you know, there's hope.
There is. No, really.
We will survive. We can.
Awesome. Yeah. Tim, thank you so much for talking to us.
All right. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too.
Care.
Bye.
Bye.
And thank you to Nina Carigia for that interview with Tim Meyer, the head of communications at Triumph National Laboratory for Particle Nuclear Physics here at UBC. And now it is time for our weekly health segment brought to you by our news health team. And this one is about vitamin D.
Hi, everyone. This is Monday, and it's time for Dietetic Intuition, your source for precise nutrition advice.
All right. So the sun is out, and everyone is out there and ready to play. So what are we talking about today? It's vitamin D and how it relates to skin cancer, but also talking about the benefits that you can get. So we want to discuss the balance between getting enough vitamin D to optimize your health versus overdosing. And some stats that might be important to you is that 75,000 new cases in Canada for skin cancer are affecting Canadians every year. So a big question that many of you may have is, what is vitamin D? It's a fat-soluble vitamin, and it functions to increase calcium absorption to support bone health. It regulates immune system in the body, and it also prevents different types of cancers. And there are two sources that you can get your vitamin D from. So the most common that we probably know of is through food sources, and you can get them from fortified milk, fatty fish, fortified yogurt, egg yolks, and others. You can also, well, vitamin D is produced in the body through your skin. So what's interesting is for lighter skinned individuals, just 5 to 15 minutes in the sun can produce an adequate amount. And if you're darker skinned, it's a little bit longer. It's 30 minutes. But we will elaborate on those guidelines a little later. Thank you. So I'm going to drop it over to Andrea.
Okay, so I just wanted to talk to you about the science behind some of this. So there have been many recent health studies that have been published recently, almost about 100, that strongly associate spending more time in the sun with lower rates of up to 15 different types of cancer. And these cancers include breast cancer, bladder cancer, lung cancer, cervical cancer, and that's just to name a couple. Health Canada also recently updated the recommendations for vitamin D to support this new science. So originally it was about 400 international units or IU of vitamin D per day. Now it's currently 600 international units per day. And this is for children who are older than 4 and adults who are less than 70 years old. Now, I know that there have been a lot of questions regarding vitamin D. It's definitely a hot topic. So some of the ones that we've gotten recently we'll share with you. So first one, can I overdose on vitamin D from sun exposure? And our answer to that is no. Your body will naturally stop producing vitamin D when it has made enough. But can you overdose from vitamin D on supplements? And our answer to this is yes. This type of vitamin D is already in its absorbable form and will make its way directly into your blood. So the body can't regulate vitamin D that's taken orally through supplements. So if you are taking supplements, just make sure that you stick to Canada's health guideline about taking about 100 IUs per day, just to, as Sharon mentioned before. Okay, last question. Does sun exposure increase your chance of getting skin cancer? And yes, there are concerns about getting too much sun. For example, you might get wrinkles, age spots, skin cancer, etc. The important thing to note is that sun exposure is a balancing act, and it's really important to follow the guidelines for sun exposure that Sharon mentioned beforehand. So I'll just pass it over to Jess right now, and she'll be talking to you about who should really be concerned about getting enough sun this summer.
Alrighty, so you're considered to be in a risk group if you're pregnant or if you're breastfeeding. Infants don't get enough vitamin D through breast milk alone. If you're an adult over the age of 50, as your skin decreases its ability to convert the active form of vitamin D within your body. If you're a dark-skinned individual, people with limited sunlight exposure, either in the very north or southern parts of the world, vegans or people who restrict vitamin D-rich foods, such as dairy products. And so basically the bottom line is most people, except those in the risk groups noted above, can get enough vitamin D if they eat enough vitamin D-rich foods, for example, milk, eggs, vitamin D-fortified foods, and fatty fish, such as salmon. And if they engage in combination a proper amount of sun exposure, so they engage in safe sun practices. So let's talk about this balancing act when it comes to sun exposure, getting enough vitamin D versus increasing your risk of skin cancer. So most light-skinned people can make enough vitamin D within 5 to 15 minutes of warm sunshine to the face and arms without sunscreen or an equivalent surface area of skin each day. For people with darker skin, the time required increases to half an hour or more depending on exactly how dark your skin is. If you're concerned about your vitamin D status, you can always get your blood tested under the supervision of a physician, and you can also talk to a dietitian as they are extremely knowledgeable about all things food and nutrition related.
So that's your segment for this week. Thanks for tuning in. Next week, we'll be back with a special feature on fiber and seasonal fruits that you should try. And we just want to note that you can check out our podcast for this segment on our blog, which is blogs.ubc.ca/dietetics-intuition. And please follow us on Twitter at CITR Health and find us on Facebook at Dietetics Intuition. All right, Vancouver, stay happy and healthy.
Anything is possible!
Cinco Cinco Wednesdays at the Cobalt. $5 cover, $5 draft, and $5 highballs. A weekly showcase of up-and-coming bands, artists, and DJs, where the artists get 100% of their ticket sales. For more information, visit thecobalt.ca.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. We're broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And you can check out that health segment as well as our interviews with Tim Meyer and Anita Mothead on our website citr.ca/news. And now it is time for your provincial and national headlines.
The BC government has unveiled a new repayment assistance program to help university graduates repay their student loans. Student loan payments can now be partially relieved for people whose incomes are above the thresholds of the existing student loan interest relief program. BC Premier Christy Clark announced the new assistance plan on the 25th of June as part of her, quote, Families First agenda. In an email to the UBC newspaper, a Ministry of Advanced Education spokesperson, Belginder Jacques, said that the repayment assistance program ensures that those paying back student loans will not need to give more than 20% of their monthly income towards provincial student loan repayment. The program is an adjustment to a previously existing provincial student loan relief plan. Under the new plan, those unable to repay their loans can apply for what is called a Stage 1 relief, in which the province will pay a portion of the borrower's interest. After 5 years on interest relief, or if someone has been repaying their loans for 10 years in total, they can apply for Stage 2, at which point the government can pay down some of the principal on the loan. If the full amount of the loan is not paid off after 15 years, the government will relieve what remains. But NDP education critic Michelle Mungall doesn't think that the new repayment options go far enough. Mungall said, quote, "It's just a re-announcement of an existing program that's had a few changes to align with a federal government program. It's not substantive. It's not addressing the major issues around student debt and affordability for post-secondary education," end quote. Mungall also said her party would prefer to see more money to go to grants that students can apply for while they're still in school, rather than student loan relief after they're finished.
A new study led by researchers at the University of British Columbia has shown that plastic pollution off the northwest coast of North America is reaching a very high level and is close to the levels found in birds on the notoriously polluted North Sea between the coasts of Britain and Scandinavia. The study, published online in the journal Marine Pollution Bulletin, examined stomach contents of beached northern fulmars, which are gull-like relatives of albatross, on the coasts of British Columbia, Canada, and the states of Washington and Oregon in the U.S. Northern fulmars forage exclusively at sea and retain ingested plastics for a long period of time, making them ideal indicators for marine littering. Analysis of beached fulmars has been used to monitor plastic pollution in the North Sea since the 1980s. The latest findings, when compared to previous similar studies, indicate a substantial increase in plastic pollution over the past four decades. Stephanie Avery Gome, the study's lead author and a graduate student in UBC's Department of Zoology, and her research group performed autopsies on 67 beached northern fulmars and found that 92.5% had plastics, such as twine, styrofoam, and candy wrappers, in their stomach. An average of 36.8 pieces of plastic per bird were found. An average total weight of plastic was 0.385 grams per bird. One bird was found with 454 pieces of plastic in its stomach. The researchers propose annual monitoring of trends in plastic pollution and the effectiveness of marine waste reduction strategies.
A group of professors and graduate students. A group of professors and graduate students from the Department of Biology at the University of Ottawa is calling on Canadians to participate in a rally in Ottawa mourning the, quote, death of evidence, end quote. The July 10th ralliers will protest what they see as a governmental campaign against science through various program cuts. The rally is designed as a funeral procession with evidence as the deceased. Participants are instructed to wear either a lab coat or black clothing and walk from the Ottawa Conference Center to Parliament Hill. Katie Gibbs, a PhD student in the biology department, will be directing the service. She was at the casual meeting with others in her department when the group came up with the idea to hold a funeral for evidence. According to Gibbs, the group, quote, "felt like we had had enough and that somebody needed to speak out against the cut to scientific programs. We want to let Canadians know that these aren't just a part of regular budget cuts. We think that what's happening here is a systematic campaign to reduce the flow of scientific information to Canadians," end quote. The group was spurred by cuts to programs including Omnibus Budget Bill C-38, but Gibbs emphasized that this would not be a protest against a specific piece of legislation. And those were your provincial and national headlines on News 101. We are now going to go to international news brought to you by FSRN.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Provisional results are in following Libya's first democratic election since the fall of former leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Interim Prime Minister Mahmoud Jibril has reportedly won by a wide margin. Jibril called on the new Congress to establish a panel to draft a new constitution ahead of elections early next year. Egypt's High Court ruled today that recently elected President Mohamed Morsi cannot override their June decision to disband Parliament. Presidential spokesperson Yasser Ali announced yesterday that Morsi had overturned the court.
The president has decided, first, to withdraw the decision to dissolve the parliament as of June 15th. Second, the elected parliament is to convene and exercise its powers as stated in the constitutional announcement issued on March 30th, 2011. And third, parliamentary elections are to be held within 60 days from the date when the people accept the referendum on the new constitution.
It's the latest in the political tug-of-war that pits the country's new president against the High Court and the military, both of which seek to delete the power the Muslim Brotherhood gained in recent elections. Just before the June presidential poll, The court said that the rules under which the parliament was elected were unconstitutional. Just days later, the military ordered the legislature be dissolved. 700 nursing home workers in Connecticut are still on strike today. Friday afternoon, the National Labor Relations Board issued a fifth complaint against their employer after the corporation instituted unilateral changes to the contract renewal it had been negotiating with workers at five nursing homes. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven.
The nurses, nursing assistants, and laundry, dietary, and housekeeping staff began walking picket lines last Tuesday after officials at Healthbridge Care One made changes to 38 of 39 articles in the existing contract, which expired in March 2011. Deborah Chernoff, spokeswoman for 1199 SEIU, says the changes include a big increase in the cost of health insurance premiums, as well as cuts in hours, in sick time, vacation, pension, and starting wages of new workers. She says it's an attack on the union itself.
What the employer has said to us is that this is a contract they want. They don't want any worker who's in a union to make any have any benefit that's better, any wage that's better, or any working condition that's better than the non-union workers, and that's exactly what they've imposed.
The company says a wage increase it added to the proposed renewal contract is evidence of its good faith. The NLRB is calling for Healthbridge to reimburse the employees' lost wages and benefits. A hearing is scheduled for September 10th in Hartford. Chernoff says the strike will continue until workers get a satisfactory negotiated settlement. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
A curfew is in place today across parts of Nigeria's troubled Plateau State after scores were killed when herdsmen attacked several villages inhabited by farmers. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
Some reports put the number of dead at more than 100 in the attacks carried out by herdsmen from the Fulani ethnic group on villages inhabited by the Birom, who are farmers. The first attacks occurred on Saturday. Another round of killings took place on Sunday, when mourners attending a mass burial for the victims of Saturday's incident were attacked. A national senator and a state legislator were among those killed during Sunday's attack. About 50 of the victims were burnt to death inside a church compound where they had taken refuge. Plateau State has seen years of conflict over land rights between Fulani pastoralists, who are settlers, and the indigenous Birom farmers. Nigeria is Africa's most densely populated nation. As population rates continue to increase, fertile land is getting scarce. In many parts of the country, years of bloody conflicts often result when rival ethnic groups compete for land. Sam Lukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
President Obama called on Congress today to roll back Bush-era tax cuts for taxpayers who make more than $250,000 a year.
I'm not proposing anything radical here. I just believe that anybody making over $250,000 a year should go back to the income tax rates we were paying under Bill Clinton. Back when our economy created nearly 23 million new jobs, the biggest budget surplus in history, and plenty of millionaires to boot.
Further, President Obama proposed leaving the tax cuts in place for another year for the 98% of individual taxpayers and 97% of small businesses that make less than $250,000 each year. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas approved a plan today to exhume the remains of former leader Yasser Arafat after an Al Jazeera investigation revealed scientific evidence of radioactive poison on his final belongings, including his toothbrush. His widow says the exhumation will be done as soon as possible. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
As the global population continues to increase and countries struggle in the face of pollution and extreme weather, a new report warns that indigenous peoples in every region of the world face the risk of being driven from their land. More than 370 million people from the Batwa in Central Africa to hill tribes of northern Thailand could be affected as competition for natural resources fuels an increasing number of conflicts. FSRN's Ron Corbin has this report from Bangkok.
The unprecedented demand for natural resources is already feeding ethnic conflict and displacement, according to the report published by the London-based human rights group Minority Rights Group International. Carl Soderberg is a spokesperson with the organization.
Everyone is chasing, all governments are chasing a dominant development paradigm in which today minorities and indigenous peoples don't really have a place. And that is the problem.
Soderberg says the Latin America communities are threatened by mining and logging, North American tribes by tar sands extraction, and African herders and farmers by land grabs from corporations and foreign governments. In China, the mining industry has forced herders off traditional grazing lands and people from ancestral villages in regions such as Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, as well as in Tibet. Mineral extraction, the timber industry and rubber plantations in Cambodia's Prey Lung Forest region has forced many people to give up traditional livelihoods. And conflict in Indonesia has resulted following the expansion of the palm oil and mining industries. Nicole Girard is Asia Program Director for Minority Rights Group International. She says conflicts over land are connected to foreign investment.
It's definitely increasing, but what the resource exploitation in Indigenous peoples' territories. But one of the reasons in Southeast Asia, the most clear reason, is because the economies of Laos and Vietnam are opening to more foreign investment, including lots of Chinese investment, including Burma.
Girard says the increased fighting in Myanmar's ethnic-controlled Kachin state over the past year is directly linked to conflict over resource investment, largely by Chinese business. While Myanmar is undergoing a series of economic and political reforms led by the military-backed civilian government of President Thein Sein, development is not inclusive, says Noor San, General Secretary of the Students and Youth Congress Burma.
We also worry that since 60 years, Obama natural resources was totally want to control by the central government or the military regime. So that is happened. So what need for ethnic is that we need the equality for the ethnic people have a national equality and democracy and development. All things should be done. It's a foundation of the state.
The Asia Indigenous Peoples Pact Foundation, in a separate report, noted that two-thirds of the 370 million self-identified Indigenous peoples are in Asia. But the group says Indigenous groups are currently marginalised and subordinated economically, politically and culturally, and overrepresented among the poor, illiterate, malnourished and stunted. A coordinator with the group, Bernice Aquino-See, says governments give priority to economic ventures and investments over people's rights.
There is already a lot of Chinese investments in the region, a lot. And many governments are aggressively actually trying to attract Chinese investments into their countries. This is because, for instance, many Chinese companies are not under any international standards for these other companies, private companies from like India and China. They don't adhere to any of these business and human rights standards.
Advocates like Bernice C say that world leaders need to respect the UN's declaration of the rights of indigenous peoples.
The Asian governments, most of the Asian governments, voted for the adoption of the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And there is a provision for free prior of informed consent from indigenous peoples for any development that comes into their territory. These governments should have the moral obligation to respect this agreement, this declaration that they have adopted in favor of, and therefore they should use it as a framework for dealing with indigenous peoples.
The report also released an index of peoples under threat, highlighting countries around the world where the risk of mass killing is the greatest. The index is also used as an early warning tool for international agencies. Those most under threat are peoples in Africa, including Somalia, Sudan, South Sudan, Ethiopia and Democratic Republic of Congo. Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran and Myanmar also top the list. The report concludes if the guarantee of safety from arbitrary killing is, in legal and moral terms, a human right, in today's world, it is also a luxury. Ron Corbin, FSRN.
In Sudan, the government continues a crackdown on protesters, arresting an opposition leader and using tear gas against students in Khartoum over the weekend. Security agents took Kama Omar of the Popular Congress Party from his home on Saturday night. Students and the opposition party have been rallying for weeks in cities across Sudan against the ruling National Congress Party and President Omar al-Bashir. The unrest takes place as tens of thousands remain displaced by fighting in South Kordofan and Blue Nile. As South Sudan marks the one-year anniversary of independence today, the border area remains volatile. Human rights observers also warn of a refugee crisis and rising mortality rates in overcrowded camps. Many of those affected are children. UN Radio's Charles Appel has more.
Boys and girls, some as young as five, carry buckets and basins of water in their hands and on their heads. They are among scores of children who have fled conflict in Sudan's Nuba Mountains for relative calm in neighboring South Sudan. Shawal Nabil, a sharply dressed young man, explains.
Actually, it is because of war. Because there's no good security. Bombs and all other harmful actions the enemies are doing against us. So we had to run from there to here for safety. And as we stay in the secured place, we take advantage of secured place and be in the school.
The children have made it to Yida, a transit site in South Sudan, either on their own or with teachers from the boarding schools they attended back home. Umjuma Ali, a teacher, tells how she rescued nearly 600 little girls.
And then I write the letters to each and every community. Any girl separately from the parent without mother or father, I can allow her to come with me in the compound until I got a very big number. It's 560 girls in the compound.
According to the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, several thousand unaccompanied children are now in Yida, which is located a few kilometers inside South Sudan. The children want to go to school, but Yida is far from a safe haven. Last November, four bombs fell there. One landed in a primary school for refugee children. Mohammed Ibrahim Malfa says thankfully it did not explode.
Where it has fallen, it fell inside the school, and even it found six young boys inside. Where exactly it has fallen? It has fallen even just next to the house where these boys were. And in fact, there was nothing happened to them. They were just okay.
UNHCR has repeatedly asked the refugees to move away from the volatile border, but with little success. The agency has shifted more than 2,000 teenagers out of Yida, where they attend secondary school in another town. A few hundred other children were also moved to a different location where they study alongside local children. The young refugees now have to fend for themselves, perhaps for the first time in their lives. They have to cook, clean, and fetch water, among other chores. While they are coping with these changes, they say nothing can replace what they have left behind. Once again, Shawal Nabil.
I will only go when the place is secured and have good condition for studies and settlement.
Shawal Nabil, one of thousands of children who have escaped fighting in Sudan's Nuba Mountains for relative safety in South Sudan. Charles Appel, United Nations.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio News for those international headlines. More headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. We'd also like to throw a shout out to FSRN's sponsorship drive and their goal of $75,000. Without this, there's a good chance that they would be shut down permanently. As our listeners know, Free Speech Radio News is a fantastic progressive news source that provides great international coverage, and we encourage you to check out their website, fsrn.org, and support them. And that's our program for today, July 9th. Today's newscast is brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to get involved or share your comments or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. Today's show was produced by CJ, and from the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands right here on CITR 101.9 FM.